Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. And this is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups that Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of that if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together. Much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, and maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're on the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. Every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the remedy and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I thank you for your ramble and for the disclaimer that you've given us all to learn and understand from. Let me start off the conversation tonight by repeating something that I had said last week, and I want to expand upon it and share with you a new offering that will be available to you shortly that I think should pique your interest greatly. In addressing matters of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, Madison said in the Federalist Papers, number 39, quote, "Its jurisdiction extends to certain enumerated objects only and leaves to the several states a residuary and inviolable sovereignty over all other objects." He said this January 26, 1788. Just 85 years later, nearly immediately following our Civil War, in a court decision known as U.S. versus Anthony, 24 Fed 829, this is 1873, quoting from this decision, it says, "The term resident and citizen of the United States is distinguished from a citizen of one of the several states in that the former is a special class of citizen created by Congress." Now, you need to understand, or I need to understand to explain to you well, that when the Articles of Confederation came in, there was but one land and one people. Yes, it was divided into 13 subcategories we called states, having the respective land and having the respective citizens of each state. But collectively, it was all under one umbrella. And it wasn't but a half a dozen years later that our founding fathers met again in Philadelphia. And there they amended the Articles of Confederation. They renamed it a Constitution for the United States of America. And therein they dotted all their I's, crossed all their T's, and they were very specific about very specific things, as you well know when you read it. Under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, they carved out a separate piece of land, or lands, rather, plural, that were 10 miles within the seat of power, so that it required some donation of land from a couple of the several states in Union. And it also created all territories, possessions, and enclaves, all of which the Congress had sole jurisdiction over. And having sole jurisdiction, for those people who were former colonists, who were subject to the king, likewise, these men and women of these territories, possessions, and enclaves, as well as 10 miles within the seat of power, are also now subject to the Congress. What's changed? Nothing. Just different names. That's all. Just change the names. The same respects are put in place as far as duties and obligations. This is as juxtaposed to the citizens of the several states who have their rights and liberties from the Almighty One, whose land can be held in elodium, they're different. These people exist only at the pleasure of the Congress, just as colonists existed only at the pleasure of the king. The beautiful thing about the argument here is that one never asserts anything, but requires the government to, upon challenge of their assertions that you are on government land, federal land, that you are a federal citizen, to make them to challenge that and make them evidence upon the record the land jurisdiction and the class of citizenship. Now, the new service that we will be offering, I'd like to say shortly, but I'm going to just coach that with truly, we hope it's shortly. But we're going to be doing another project very soon where we're going to assist you, if you wish, in a change in changing the classification that the federal government actually has on you. And we'll change you from them showing you on their paper, on their end, you being a federal citizen, to you being a citizen within the freely associated compact states, effectively kind of making you having diplomatic immunity, if you would, within the federal zones. So to that end, I just wanted to share with you this exciting news. What you're going to hear from PJ tonight is the fact that all of the issues that we have today that you're being slammed with is predicated upon the assertion, the assumption, you're a federal citizen. Federal citizens don't have rights. They have privileges. And you know you have you're exercising a privilege when first you go to them for permission, and then upon being granted permission, collecting some tax money, giving you all sorts of rules and regulations and stipulations upon which you may exercise that privilege, you then have a license to do whatever it is that you're doing. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to PJ. Go ahead, buddy.
Okay. Yeah, essentially there's the primary jurisdiction of American soil, which often is we call the United States or the States United. Actually, it's better term the States United. For various reasons. But anyway, the general jurisdiction of that land area is common law. The special jurisdiction is United States jurisdiction, which is limited by the United States Constitution, which is a document that is assembled by the people and is the limitations of the entity called the United States. So if you're, it's my belief that anytime any court comes after you, they have to prove up the jurisdiction that they're claiming on the onset. So when they come against you with a parking ticket, they're going to pull you into a United States court. You just ask them. It's just ask the administrator, the judge. There are no judges in the United States. They're all administrators. But anyway, they like to be called judge. So I call them judge anyway. But anyway, when I'm in court, I ask them, am I in a United States court? And they've always said yes. And then I ask them, what does the moving party rely upon that I, as a man, am subject to the United States courts at this time? And then if the judge has a half a brain, he'll turn to the opposing party. And usually I give him a brief before this. He'll turn to the opposing party and ask them to produce that evidence. And it's been quite interesting at times. It doesn't make if you have a parking ticket or a murder case. If it's a United States court, they have to prove their evidence that that court has jurisdiction. Most jurisdiction of the United States, maybe all of it, is land associated. So essentially, they have to get a land, what I call a nexus. They have to get evidence of an activity done inland that is of the United States. Now, 24 to 25% of American land is of the United States. So, but it's most likely you didn't do anything inland of the United States. You didn't speed. You weren't speeding, a parking ticket, making income, the property tax issues, federal tax issues, state tax issues, fishing license, hunting license, all of that. It's very likely there is no state nexus, zero. But driver's requirement to have a driver's license, insurance, registration, all that stuff is land jurisdiction associated. So real common, if you get pulled over, no license, no registration, no insurance, you can challenge the jurisdiction of the court as to what does the moving party have as evidence that that U.S. court, which includes the written law that they're bringing against you, has authority over you as a man. And then the next jurisdictional challenge is the over the subject matter, which is the activity. And then, of course, all that ties into territorial jurisdiction. They call it aggregate jurisdiction, land jurisdiction. It's all synonymous. And it really puts them in quite a bind because the administrator, the judge sitting there, has a requirement for that to be placed on the evidence, on the record. Now, if you don't say anything, they do put it on the record stealthily without you even knowing it. So when you're in a federal court, they always ask somebody. The pleadings always says that it occurred in the county, in the state, in the city. And if you don't object, you just gave them evidence of land jurisdiction. Now, if they have land, if they have land jurisdiction on the record, they don't have to prove personal jurisdiction, because if you did something in their land, they do have personal jurisdiction. So you've really got to watch for that. What Michael's talking about here is the distinct jurisdictions of within the state and without the state. So when they talk about their state jurisdiction, their statutes will say within the exterior boundaries of the state of Nebraska or the state of Texas. Okay. Within the exterior boundaries of the state of Nebraska. What they're actually saying is within land that is of the United States. Because state of Iowa, state of Texas, state of Nebraska, state of Florida is the same as saying a federal zone. So they're getting the evidence before the court that the activity occurred within the land jurisdiction of the court, and the judge says, okay, move to the next thing, bring up the proceed with the case. And what we do is we provide a means. For example, let's say you make $100,000 a year or $10,000 a year at a specific location doing just business there. Maybe you do a lot of different kinds of business. You sell lemonade, you sell pop, you sell oil changes, whatever. They come after you for state and federal property. Or state and federal taxes. We have ways to force them to produce the evidence that they rely upon. We can't force them to produce evidence. We just force them to produce evidence that they rely upon that the written law of the United States applies there, as far as like Title 26 for taxes. And it completely keeps the burden of proof on them. And then when they stumble over that and they have all kinds of excuses, then we put a brief in front of the judge, and we actually force the judge to turn to the opposing party and produce evidence that that activity that you're doing is not a right. Now, if it is a right, it can't be taxed. If it's not a right, it's something else, which they always call it a privilege, benefit, or a service. And, of course, privilege, benefit, or service from the United States is taxable. It's business that is taxable. So they have to produce one or the other. They have to produce evidence that, there's a, that you're doing, you're generating income domestically, inland, that is evidenced as being of the United States. They can't do that. They don't have any business applying the legislative written laws to you. Now, this is the last thing they want you to figure out, and this is the first thing they will be ready to block in a court. So what we do is we have pretty elaborate briefs, memorandums of law that we submit into the record. We don't ask for permission to do this. We put it in the record, and we give judicial notice to the court. We give judicial notice that, in a nutshell, if it is a right, how can it be taxed? It's a maximum law that a right cannot be taxed. And if it can be taxed, then it's not a right. Okay, so we force down to produce evidence that your activity at a specific location is not a right. They have to produce evidence that it's a privileged service or benefit.
Oh, excuse me.
So, it gets pretty exciting about that time because Title 26 is based on a certain activity of an individual that has the land jurisdiction of the United States. Now, they'll claim that a United States citizen is taxable abroad because he's domestically a perpetual resident of the District of Columbia. Now, that, too, can possibly be challenged because, and I don't know if it's, I don't think it's ever been challenged because the their written laws clearly say that income generated domestically by someone in the United States. So how can you, let's say you go out and you throw a fishing line into a lake and you pull out a fish. Now, how can that be converted in, if that land is not of the United States, if that space is not of the United States, how can that can be converted into fishing in the United States? You might be fishing, the person fishing might be a naturalized citizen from Mexico, but he's still not catching a fish in the United States. I think it would be a very interesting challenge. But we're not too worried about naturalized citizens because they usually don't go after naturalized citizens because they usually ring them in pretty fast other ways. But as far as a native-born individual, if you're born in the middle of Texas or Pennsylvania or any area of land, and that's on the record as an affirmative defense, they have to produce evidence of what their nexus of law application is. Michael, we got any questions popping up yet?
Well, let's take a look. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Star 2 to raise your hand. For those of you listening on Freedoms Radio, you'll see a rectangle of a silhouette laying on its side. Simply left-click inside of it. Type away your comment or your question. On the outside of it, you'll see a place to put your name, your contact information, then hit submit, and I'll be happy to give voice to your comment or question. So if we were at this moment, nobody's raised their hand. I think we caught them off guard. But start thinking about your questions, please, ladies and gentlemen. We got about 30 minutes remaining on the call, and we'd like to get some good questions going. PJ, back to you.
Yeah, what we need to do is we need to some people, they say that you're wasting your time when you do this in traffic situations. Your cars get towed, you pay a bunch of fines and tickets and fees when you try to travel without state registration. But if you, in my experience, if you have the right people with you it's an excellent practice to you know, just purchase a vehicle and put on the dash that, you know, that you're the owner, so that if they ever see it, they can contact you and put it close to the VIN number, the chassis number. Never cover up the chassis number. That's a good way to get towed real fast. Make sure you don't cover that number up. And go at it, because you have a right to travel. Now, I would advise doing this inland that is not of the United States, because it makes it a lot easier, which is not all that hard generally for most people. And when they start requiring that you have license, registration, insurance, then you can actually sue them if they push it to a towing situation, and maybe it'll make a pretty good living doing it, because they are violating your rights under a color of law. So basically, some people in District of Columbia passes a law that the states can regulate motor vehicle transportation in the given state associated with federal government. Is, for example, the state of Texas. They didn't say Texas. They say the state of. Or they say, now when you go to the state of Texas and you look up state, it'll have state or in this state or this state. And they'll all have the same definitions. And the definition will be possession or territory of the United States. And they usually hide it. The way to find it is you take their entire motor vehicle statute, copy and paste it into a Word document, do a word search on state defined, and it usually finds it. Whereas if you try to do that by looking at every single line in that thing, it could take you hours. But that's the way I found it. And you type in this state, state, and then state of Texas. And generally those three or four things will locate it for you. And every time you see it, it's going to have it defined as a possession or territory of the United States. If it's a possession or territory of the United States, what land jurisdiction is it? It's the land jurisdiction of a United States, possession or territory of the United States. Possession or territory is referencing a land area, and the land jurisdiction proprietary-wise is listed as the United States. So when they come at you for requiring license, registration, or insurance, first thing they have to prove is if you had activity in the possession or territory of the United States. And that's really, they don't want this being exposed at all, because all this motor vehicle stuff is almost completely a scam. They have written laws to apply license to certain activity in their land, but they take it and they apply it everywhere, and they make billions of dollars off of it, and they control the entire society. And most society doesn't want to fight it, and they don't know how to fight it, and we end up losing a tremendous amount of our freedom just because people don't want to challenge the most basic principle of their life, and that's the right to travel. I wish we could get an area, a large area, like 100,000 people, to the vast majority of them would challenge this in the courts. And then we could take that and show the rest of the nation the principle of land jurisdiction. Because once you're able to establish the land jurisdiction distinctions of the right to travel in a specific land that is not evidence of the possession of territory of the United States, then people will sit back and say, well, what else are they deceiving us with? And that's going to shoot into the area of property taxes, sales taxes. They can only charge sales tax in their land. They can only charge property tax upon land that they own. The whole, just a tremendous scam. Now, a lot of people think that society cannot operate unless this superior entity called the United States, which is the same thing as saying the state of Nebraska or Texas or Iowa, any of the 50. They say, that, oh, society can't function unless we allow them to do this. And that's a bunch of baloney. Matter of fact, the society can't function if you do let them do it. Because little by little, people lose their ability to self-govern. When you drive through a small town at the speed limit of 45 miles an hour, most of the people who live there may say that it's a perfectly fine speed limit. But they got a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit out there where they write tickets all day and all night long. And they just generate income. And guess what? They seldom write tickets to the people that live there. And it's just organized crime. So I recommend that people, Michael might be able to, get a package together to work with people that want to join in and exercising their right to travel, because it's extremely good practice in every area of their claim of land jurisdiction. Which eventually, once you understand that and you get confidence in that, then you can go to property taxes. And that's a big sacred cow to them, because that's how they govern society, is with property taxes. That's how they pay for their state-run schools, with property taxes. That's how statism is maintained in America, is predominantly by property taxes. And then we can go into federal and state taxes, and that's another huge area where they take control of people through federal and state taxes. Can you imagine having a society that doesn't pay any automobile taxes, no sales taxes, no federal taxes, no state taxes, and the money stays in the community? It stays in the community. You do that for a few hundred years, can you imagine the wealth that's built up there? It's just incredible. So, any questions? Come on, people.
Yeah, we have to have some questions. We're going to have a real early call tonight, and I just can't believe that's going to happen. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen.
This is pretty exciting stuff. If anybody does raise their hand, go ahead and cut into my conversation.
Okay, well, Nancy, go ahead. What you got to say?
Okay.
Well, it was my question is about, the automobile. If you buy a car and then you register it, you're not the owner, because the state has the title. And
they cannot be the owner unless you knowingly and willingly gave your property to them. And if you bring it into a common law setting, you get 6 or 12 people on the jury, the state's going to have a horrible time convincing that jury that you knowingly and willingly gave your car to the state. So it's just a lie. I mean, the state's going to say that. You know, that car is registered. That car is registered, therefore we got jurisdiction. It's not true. The only way they can have a type of proprietary association with that automobile is if the owner gave it to them with full disclosure. Some people might do that. That's
well,
fine.
Example, like, If your car was at one time, you had a title, you titled it in whatever name, your own name or the name of a trust or something, and then you didn't pay the registration after that. So you're traveling around in a automobile that was once titled to them. But then you're not paying the current registration anymore. Where does that leave you?
They have to prove that it was titled to them. they have to produce evidence that somebody, the owner, gave it to them, and they don't have that. I mean, in most cases, they don't have that because the owner would say, "Hell no, I didn't do that. I did that because they keep giving me a ticket every day of the week if I didn't do it." And then,
right?
And then
we're all just brainwashed into their.
This is why we need to pull together on this. We can explain to the jury that they have right to license and register certain, demand their license and register of certain vehicles. They have that right, but they don't have that right to the general man, because he doesn't live on their land and he's not one of their statutory persons. So they don't have any authority. Where in the Constitution are you required to license and register your car? If you're a statutory person, it's in the Constitution. If you live on their land, it's in the Constitution. So if it's not in the Constitution, then they have to find contract. And the only way a contract can operate is with full disclosure, which I don't think they'd ever have with somebody like you, because you would say, "No, I didn't willingly register that, pay anything, or get a driver's license even." And see, you can't have a driver's license unless you live on government land. So when you get pulled over and you hand them a driver's license, you just told the whole court system and the police officer, if it goes right into the appeals court, the higher level courts, you just told them that you live on government land. Because that's the only way you can get a driver's license if you're a resident of the state of Texas, for example. You can't get a driver's license from the state of Texas unless you're a resident of the state of Texas. And the only way you can be a resident of the state of Texas is if you live on their land. So they have to produce evidence that you live on their land if you challenge it. So you show them
that word resident. That's a red flag right there. That word means you're in there on their land.
That's exactly right. If you go to their statute, the resident means that you live on their land. They have to produce that. If you challenge it, they have to produce it. You don't have to produce a negative. They have to produce the positive fact. If the driver's license, see, when they start going down this dark alley, they realize, like, oh boy, this is bad. This is exposure. And my experience is they bug out. They just dismiss the case. Now, what we need to do is when they start dismissing the case, we need to get a process in there to publicly sue them so that the public can actually know that they misbehaved and they had to pay a certain amount of money because of their misbehavior. And the people can look at it. Well, what was their misbehavior? Oh, they pulled Jennifer over on Highway 52 out there 3 months ago and gave her a speeding ticket. And they go, yeah. Well, what's the big deal? Well, they don't have any authority to do that. They could pull you over and process you in common law. But they got to convince a jury, at least a petite jury, that your activity was dangerous. And then it doesn't touch the statutory world. It just touches the common law world, which they don't want to do that because the state doesn't get enriched very well through the common law process. The fine stays with the people. The fine doesn't go to the state. And they go, well, why would we want to do that? The fine doesn't come in our direction. We go broke doing that. Well, anyway, that's life. It's just disgusting when people have a whole community that's being turned into a statism mentality. And they're being robbed. I don't care. I don't care if they, you know, I had one neighbor that was worth $70 million, probably $150 million recently. if you adjusted for inflation, another neighbor is worth $30 million. I don't care if you're making that much money. You still have a duty to stand up and keep statism out of America. The statism destroys the freedom of the American way, American people. It's evil. Taxation is a form of theft, unless it's consensual. And the Constitution even says that. The consent of the governed. If you want to be governed, you got to consent to it. And that's the American way. Being born here is not consent. And besides, born doesn't make you essentially obligated anyway. That's why everything starts being activated at the age of 18 in America, because that's the first time that you can contract with the United States. So, and that's common law principle that they've adopted. But when you go into a U.S. court, there's only two things they're going to enforce, either a contract or written law. So, and oftentimes it's both. So, but anyway, it's an opportunity to practice, and the same thing with property taxes, challenge the property taxes. And they're just raping us, and it's getting bad. A lot of people didn't complain about federal taxes when it started because it was only 0.5%. Then it went into 1%. And when Carter was around, they had some inflation issues, I think. I think he was charging 85% tax. So, and it's, they can tax their persons 100% if they want. They're going to lose a lot of clients if they do that, especially if people learn that, hey, that's a relationship that need not exist. And they can people can learn to live independent of the United States, predominantly. So
one thing to really remember regarding the taxes, like on the land, the property taxes, et cetera, is whoever owns, has total title to the land, is the one that can tax the land. So when you purchase property in, Volusia County, Florida, as an example, wherever, is that federal land? Is that federal land that your brick and mortar is sitting on, or is it not? If it's federal land, then there's going to be lawfully is a property tax assigned to it, because they tax, just as the King of England taxed the colonists on the land that they occupied and sojourned around, so too the federal government taxes the land that the federal citizens sojourn about. So
right.
What PJ's doing is he's bringing to the attention of the property tax assessor that particular piece of land on this map shows that it is not federal land. So therefore, prove that it is basically what he's proposing, or what he's doing in court. Correct?
Yeah.
PJ?
Yeah. Every state has a property tax statement that says all tax in this state, and I'll just say Texas. I'm visiting Texas this week. All tax in the state of Texas is taxable. All land in the state of Texas is taxable. Title 8, Chapter 18, whatever is the state tax code. Then another area will say all property in the state of Texas is taxable. That's another area. So people look at it and like, well, okay, all the land. They think of this border that goes around the exterior boundaries of what we call Texas. Oh, it must be everything inside of that border. No. The only part of Texas that is state of Texas is government-owned land. It's probably less than a couple percent. All the rest of the land is not of the state of Texas. It might be associated with what we call as Texas. There's a lot of ways to identify land, but statutorily, they have to identify their land as state of Texas, and then they have to define the word state as a possession or territory of the United States. And then they have to rely on the Constitution's, the Articles of Confederation and the United States Constitution that clearly identifies that that land has to be owned under the specific name of the United States of America.
Good.
So if it's not under the United States of America, it's not government land.
Correct.
Go ahead.
Nancy, anything else? We've got Tanya and Harold up behind you here.
Well, I might think of something.
Go ahead and press star two again after let's get Tanya and Harold a chance here, okay? All right, one more.
All right.
Thank you. All right. Next is Tanya. Go ahead, Miss Tanya.
Hello. My question is, I went to renew my driver's license, and they wouldn't let me renew them because they said I own state taxes. I'm in Maryland, but I've never received anything from Maryland State or a comptroller about taxes.
Okay.
So what do I do about that?
The only way you can qualify and be eligible to have a state driver's license is if you live on government land. So it's you actually might be committing a crime by seeking a driver's license from the state, which they're never going to prosecute because it's a scam. So you can challenge state taxes. The state taxes are based off of a specific line on the federal taxes. And you could challenge. We challenge federal taxes. I work with people that make, $50,000 to $100,000 a month. They don't pay a dime in taxes. They don't hide from the government. And I listened to this one guy that said that he notified the government. And he told him he made $1 million a day, and he truly did. He just said. I'm not going to say who he was, but a massively large company, and he made $1 million a day. The Walmarts make $1 million an hour profit. But he challenged them to produce evidence that he had an obligation to file or pay any tax. And if you do it properly, which we have the process to do that, you can never be prosecuted for criminal action because you're asking them, hey, do I have a requirement to file here? B, do I have a requirement to pay any money to you guys? They have to answer your question.
Okay.
Now, as far as taking your driver's license away from you, what do you need a driver's license for? As I was talking about earlier, the only person that needs a driver's license is somebody who's doing commercial driving on land of the United States. I don't think you actually need a commercial driver's license to transport passengers or cargo on land that's not of the United States, because I think you're governed by common law there. They don't want anybody to know that because it screws up their system big time. But if you're not carrying passengers or cargo for a fee, the United States written law says that you're not doing an activity. Now, this is considered to be an activity in their land. You're not doing an activity that requires a obligation for license, registration, insurance. Now, if you're carrying passengers and because you have a right, see, you have a right to pass through that land. You don't have a right to set up a lemonade stand. You don't have a right to carry cargo and so forth for a profit, but you have a right to pass through it. You have a right. They can't tax a right.
Okay.
And they make it difficult for us. That's the problem.
Yeah.
We need to get away from making this. We need to punish them for making it difficult because it's a violation of our rights when they make it difficult. Now, I do know people that I know this one guy, he lived in a community of a little over 100,000 people, I believe. And he kept driving. He was a paralegal. And he, every time he got pulled over, because every cop in town knew him, because, you know, it just got around and he's driving around, no license, no registration, no insurance. Every time he got pulled over, they'd arrest him and they'd tow his car and they'd put him in jail. And every single time the judge would come to him and ask him if he'd like to, make a plea agreement. The judge would come to the jail and talk to him. I've never heard of such a thing. And he said he'd always say no and they'd let him out and return his car to him. But after the seventh time, he said it took seven times, and then they completely quit bothering him after that. Now, they should have quit the first time.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, he didn't ever go back after him, sue him. I guess he kind of enjoyed it, because when he was in jail, he was teaching everybody else the truth about it. But I experienced the same thing. I was arrested five times for no license, registration, insurance, and failure to show up in court on the one individual case. And after being arrested on that one ticket for the fifth time in front of the judge, I put a jurisdictional challenge before the judge, and I wouldn't let him wiggle out of it. And they dismissed the case right there. The sheriff walked up to me and says, "I don't know what happened in there, PJ, but case dismissed. I've never seen anything like this ever in my life." And I explained it to him. They don't have evidence of authority to apply the state written law at that location upon that activity and upon me. Quite simple. So, I don't know what Michael and I, Michael's good at brainstorming. If we can get we need to get an organization together that is just as organized as what they're using against us. They are highly organized.
I'd like to exercise the Seventh Amendment of our Constitution and create a virtual court, you know, use Zoom or whatever, and have people who have gone through the process where they are not federal citizens, even by U.S. standards. In other words, not having to go through court and go through all the rigmarole that we go through each and every time we're challenged by this state, but to simply have them correct their record on their end. And that's the process that I will be availing, hopefully, within the next 30 days. And when I do, those people will uniquely be my peer in the sense that they'll all be citizens within the freely associated compact states, and the federal government will recognize that. Then I want to go ahead and create a trial that will be operated through the Seventh Amendment of our federal Constitution, and let's see how that plays out, particularly if
exactly.
We can subpoena a state prosecutor that was prosecuting us, or the judge that was prosecuting us. Can you imagine charging a state judge with deprivation of rights under color of law? We're not citing their code, because there is a code. Title 42, Section 1983 is deprivation of rights under color of law, but also that language by itself is also common law, which is what the Seventh Amendment Court is, American common law. So that's where I'd like to take this, and that's what I'm working on.
Yes, we could. They say that we can go into a U.S. court and use 42 United States Code 1983 for someone that's acting as a United States agent, but is doing so under color of law, which is exactly what we're talking about. Let's say it's on 72nd Street in Dodge, and you get a ticket there, and run a red light, whatever, stoplight. And we should be able to go into the common law court and start a process immediately where they have to come in to that court first to prove that they can pull it into the their United States courts. Now, if they can produce that evidence, then the common law court could say, yes, okay, it's legitimate. You produce the evidence. You can go ahead and process it in the United States court. But that should be the first jurisdiction they have to, jurisdictional hurdle they have to get over is the Seventh Amendment court. And that would change everything. Now, that doesn't mean people can run a stop sign and damage people or run red lights all the time and damage people. No, the common law court, we can punish people for damaging people. That's the way it works. And we need to have that set up to do so. That's the protection of the society. So, okay, next question.
All right. Hold on a second. My screen just blipped. Yeah. One moment. Thank you, Tanya. Was there anything else?
That's it as far, but I would like to know how, I mean, do you guys have like a class or something where we can learn how to, you know, learn more of this information and know what to do?
Well, that's what we're talking about. You know, Michael and I are pretty astute on this, but, We need to bring the cookies down to the lower shelf so the people like you can feed off of it. And that's what we're working on. So we don't have nothing today, but that's something we want to get working.
All right.
It's kind of a grassroots thing. We want to bring it down to the level of the people traverse. So that's what we're putting together. We're getting sick and tired of watching people get raped by these people. This week I parked your car and they towed it. They didn't have no reason to tow it. So I'm going to sue them in a common law setting. I'm going to use the United States courtroom, or the same courtroom that United States court actions use, but I'm going to run a common law jurisdiction. And I'm going to ask for a petite jury to make a determination if they had authority to tow my car, charging $250 to get it back. It's parked alongside the road, wasn't hurting nobody, and they just towed it. It's just wrong, I believe.
Tanya, do you have my direct number?
I do not.
Okay, let me give you an 800 number. That's what I publicly publish is an 800 number, and then once I respond to that, I'll give you my direct number. The 800 number is 800-625-4250.
Okay.
You want to repeat that back?
1-800-625-4250.
Wonderful. I look forward to getting your call. Next is Harold, then followed by Norman. However, I'm going to ask you guys to allow someone to, well, for, as far as you're concerned, cut in line. He's not cutting in line. He's been pressing *2 on his end. I received a separate text from him, and it's just not working for him for whatever reason. So, Brian, could you step up and ask your question, please? And then we'll do Harold and Norman.
Oh, Michael, can you hear me?
Oh, Michael can hear you. So can everybody else. So watch your language.
PJ, I've got some getting a lot of friends in the cannabis industry, and a lot of them, you know, have been drugged through the mud, clearly. And, you know, I understand the land jurisdiction licensing and tax. Are there any other angles within that vicinity that are important or that you have worked with?
I think if you're going to raise cannabis, it gets complicated because you got to move the product around, you know, and they claim to have the jurisdiction to monitor that. If you don't, you get thrown in jail real quick. They take your airplane or your car or whatever and make it hell for you. But what you can do is you can write out a business plan and tell them, show in that business plan, tell them exactly the area where you're going to raise the product and that people are going to come to you and buy the product from you. There's not going to be no delivery. And ask the governor of the state to produce evidence that you're subject to state governance in that activity. And they're probably not going to respond to you. And then we can write them a letter again and say that they have a legal duty to respond to you, because you don't have to risk violating the law. And a common law jury would say, hey, you know, answer the question. You're the sovereign, and you're the employer. They're the employee. They're the part-time help. They have a duty to answer your question. And we could possibly sue the governor for not answering the question.
That's intriguing.
So they would have to say that no, because of your location, there is no state interest there.
Would the same apply to a dispenser?
Yes, activity. If you're making alcohol, if you're making guns, if you're doing it all within the grounds of an area, they don't have jurisdiction. They don't have state jurisdiction to govern it. They have jurisdiction on manufacturing the guns and so forth on their land, and the use of guns on their land in many ways anyway. You still have the right to bear arms when you're on their land responsibly. You do the same. Now, if you're operating under one of their license, it's kind of hard to say that, you know, I'm operating under your license and I'm not operating under your license at the same time. So you need to make a clear distinction in your question that when you talk about distributing, see, that opens up a little bit of a potential interstate commerce. But interstate commerce is a federal zone, one federal zone to another federal zone. It's not interstate commerce is not a non-federal zone to a federal zone, or a non-federal zone to a non-federal zone. It's a federal zone to a federal zone.
Only a resident can engage in interstate commerce.
Well, that's their claim anyway.
Court decision.
Yeah, I know, but just because of the court decision doesn't. You still have to have the activity in their land. The problem is if you cross there, if you don't obey exactly, then they pull your dispensary license, and then you're stuck with a product you can't move. So it gets kind of complicated. So you got to be very careful about. I would proceed with what you got going, and then pick another piece of land and ask the governor those questions about another piece of land where you're going to do that.
But do you try to pursue a license or don't have a license?
Well, try to pick a piece of land and do an activity without a license. See if they write you and say no, you got to have a license in that area. See, then we can sue them. Let's just say it's a fishing license. Something much simpler. They have to tell you if you're required to have a state fishing license in that area.
Another ranch. What about Indian land? Would that be designated federal land, or would that be their indigenous land?
It might be federal. It might not be. You go to the Bureau of Land Management.
Okay.
It's the same acronym as Black Lives Matters, but Bureau of Land Management, and then you ask them, here's a piece of land right there. Give them a map, take a magic marker, say, the land that's within that circle, that square, is any of that land owned by the United States of America? And they'll tell you.
Okay. Understood. Thank
they,
you.
They have those maps. They don't like to let anybody see them because they don't want a map popping up on the internet that says state of Texas, and then you look in there and you see these little red marks here and there. Well, what's those red marks? Oh, that's state of Texas. Why is it red? That's state of Texas. What do you mean? What about all the green parts? That's not state of Texas. Well, that's most of what Texas is. That doesn't make sense. See, then
right.
They start asking questions like, is there something that's kind of a scam going on here? Because the state patrol, they travel all this area. We had an individual that attended a police officer meeting once, and the guy understood the limitations of the United States. And when the officers were sent out, he says, "Now remember, you don't have authority out there. You don't have the Constitution giving you authority out there. So be careful."
Okay.
That was good.
Are we good, Brian?
Okay.
Yes, sir. Thank you. That was great.
Great. Thank you, Brian. All right. So we've got Harold, Norman, followed by Axelrod, and then Kent. So let's go with Harold.
Hi, PJ. My question is the idea of the land jurisdiction applied to building codes, whether it's residential or commercial?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. If they own the land, they can apply their municipal codes. If they do not own the land, common law is the jurisdiction. So in common law, generally you build it, and if there's a problem, the common law jury could slap your hand pretty hard if you don't take measures to build it, safely. But there's some jurisdictions around the country that don't have any zoning laws, and they do just fine. There's other areas that have zoning laws, and they do fine too. So it's best to use wisdom. But municipality is a subdivision of the state, and the state is a federal possession. So
Now these
codes, some of these codes can be applied because of a homeowners association, thing like that. So you got to be careful there.
Yeah. No, I'm talking about private.
If you're absolute owner, many of the state constitutions says that you have right to ultimate owner. Ultimate title. I mean it says it means you're the highest authority of that land, very possibly the sole owner. And but anyway, if the state ever comes, they have to prove whatever happened in history for them to have a ownership interest in that land.
Mm-hmm.
Very likely they sold it 100% of it at one time in history, but you don't know. You don't know until you ask the Bureau of Land Management, because they'll tell you if it was sold entirely or if they held back a specific portion of jurisdiction, like water rights or mineral rights or flyover rights.
Okay.
Those are pretty rare, but they do pop up at times.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Harold. I didn't realize it, but I had cut off Brian from the questions that he was doing a follow-up with. So, Norman, give me 1 minute while Brian finishes up here. Go ahead, Brian.
No, sir, I'm fine. Wanted to talk to you later on new ideas.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood. Thank you. Next is Norman, followed by Axelrod, followed by Kent. Go ahead, Norman.
Hi there. BJ, my following question is, if I own a one-acre piece of land in the state of Florida, can you confirm that I don't own that land and live on that land as federal property?
If you kind of call it state of Florida, you gave surface evidence, prima facie evidence that the state owns it. But are you talking about private land in what normally called Florida?
Yeah, I bought a piece of land in the state of Florida. It's a 1 acre plot.
If you bought it in the state of Florida, it's government land. State of Florida is government land. Florida.
So I bought the land.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, you need to contact the Bureau of Land Management, and you can ask them if the United States has an ownership interest in that land. Evidence
by
of ownership.
It's a meets and bounds description.
They'll tell you. You just think, give them a plat map and draw a circle around the borders of the land, and they'll tell you. They like to do that. They're good at that.
Okay, so if I bought the land, it's not really private land that I own. It's actually I bought government land, and the government owns it, the state of Florida or the federal, one or the other.
Anyway, ask the Land Bureau of Land Management to tell you if you own it entirely or if other parties own it with you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Next is Axelrod. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. Appreciate you taking my call. Thank you. Quick question, PJ, back to the licensing thing. If you were to stop me and I was to say that I'm traveling, does that mean anything to you?
No, it's where you're traveling. It doesn't make if you have a, let's say you have a driver's license in your pocket and you got a state plate on your car and you got registration in your glove compartment, an insurance card in your glove compartment. As long as you don't give any of that to the officer that stops you, there is no evidence of commercial activity.
So the word traveling doesn't mean anything to you. If you tell the officer that you're traveling.
You don't have to say anything. Don't say anything. Don't try to prove anything. Officer, do you have any evidence that I'm carrying passengers? In a nutshell, the law says, their law says that if you're on their land transporting passengers or cargo for a fee, which is similar to profit,
right,
then you're governable by their written law. So it's transporting passengers or cargo for a fee. So, officer, do you have any evidence that I'm transporting passengers or cargo for a fee or for profit?
But that's not why I'm pulling you over.
And then if he asks for license, registration, and insurance, you say, officer, could this lead to a criminal prosecution? He'll say yes. Well, I take the fifth. So all you have to do, you take the fifth. Now don't have that driver's license on you, because when they arrest you, they'll take it into evidence and they'll make it appear on the paperwork that you presented it to them.
You're
best having your driver's license up under the dash or something where they can't get a hold of it. The driver's license is pretty handy occasionally when you go into a bank and you want to withdraw money at some bank's stuff. They're going to require a driver's license, so it's
right.
Pretty handy to have with you. Yeah, go ahead with your question then.
So, no, because I've always been under the assumption that the word traveling means that you're it's giving you authority to drive without a license.
Well, anyway, when they prosecute you, they'll say he was traveling down Douglas Street in the county of Washington County. It's where you're doing it is the biggest thing they're going to get on the record.
So you don't think he's going to try and BS me and, so you're refusing to give me your license?
As soon as you take the Fifth, you don't have to give him anything. All you have to do is you identify yourself properly.
Okay.
Your name, your first, middle, and last name.
Right.
Basically what you're called. And then your date of birth and a mailing location.
All right. All right, listen, I appreciate your time. Go to bed. I hear you yawning.
Yeah.
Stay awake over there.
If you notice, I'm yawning here.
Yeah. Listen, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
I'm actually on a yacht, and we got the yacht stuck on a sandbar, so I had to get up like every hour last night when the tide was up and try to use the anchor to pull us off the sandbar when the tide was up. So I don't get very much.
God, life's such a bitch, huh? I appreciate your time. Thank you, sir.
60,000-pound boat doesn't move very easy. Okay, next question.
Yeah, we have Kent next, and then Ron is the last one, Ron from Coco. After that, we're going to be done for the night. Go ahead, Kent.
Okay. Yeah, good evening, Michael and PJ. Can you hear me all right?
Yep.
I want to talk or just briefly touch upon the rigmarole that you were talking about 10 or 15 minutes ago that Michael said he's working on over the next month or so to formulate a plan, because many of us are tired of going through this rigmarole issue by issue by issue. I touched on this once before, but I didn't feel like on the call that I got response I got was very receptive. But based on the way you're saying it now and a couple of things that have been said on Bernie's call, et cetera, let me reapproach this if I could. Why wouldn't it be feasible, if you thought about this, to use the 1802 naturalization law to become a citizen using their law, but not in the administrative form, well before the Civil War or the end of the Civil War, and looking at the government we have in place today or what purports to be government? Why wouldn't it be possible to use the 1802 naturalization law to actually go through that process? And one would have to take into consideration, I believe, their family history and ancestry, but then use that law to obtain a declaration that we are actually a state citizen or a citizen of one of the several states, however you would want to say it, but certainly not any part or a citizen of the federal government or the federal.
State citizen doesn't give you the freedom. You have that already. You have that inherently. It's your birthright. They have to prove that you have a activity or a contractual relationship in the United States. It doesn't have anything to do with state citizenship. They have to prove that you stepped into their jurisdiction through contract or activity. Activity is very similar to contract. They have to prove it. They have to prove the governance, what they rely upon to that you activated their written law to be applied to you. Their written law doesn't apply to you unless you do an act. A specific act.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with state citizenship.
So you don't see that what I'm talking about as being a valid process to set the record.
Not necessary. No. They don't ask. They don't ask you if you're a state citizen in the courtroom. Never have. If they get real desperate, they're going to try to get you to say that you're a U.S. citizen, but they're never going to try to get you to say that you're a state citizen. of the independent states. They're going to try to get you to say that you're a state of Texas, that you're a citizen of the state of Texas. Because if you say you're a citizen of the state of Texas, that's the same as saying you're a federal citizen.
But aren't we asking, and correct me if I'm wrong, from what I understood from listening to these calls and from what I know based on my own history and my own studies, aren't we actually saying, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, aren't we saying that we want them to recognize us as a quote-unquote citizen of one of the several states rather than as a...
No, they have to prove that you did something to enter into their jurisdiction. We don't have to worry about our jurisdiction protection on our side. They have to produce that we entered into... You might have the jurisdiction of living on the moon. They have to produce the evidence that you entered into their jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm. Kent, the end result of what I hope to have will be actual a document issued by the United States that will have, you know, name and some information on it. But most importantly, when you hand this document to a law enforcement officer, they will see that it at least has the appearance of an official U.S. Document. They'll go to their computer. They'll type in whatever the code number is that's there or scan it or however they're going to do it. And it will basically back up on their screen that says, do not detain, do not question, release. Simple as that.
And that is true. That does – people do get those occasionally. But we –
That was that.
My articles after is one that we can – we can attain without, you know, years and years of a hassle.
Is this involving the State Department?
Yes.
Because there are some people that through the passport process, from what I understand, and I'm thinking of one gentleman in particular who operates very quietly, through the passport process actually
saw
the computer.
Do you have my 800 number, Kent?
Yeah.
Call me, please.
Yeah. Okay, good enough. Thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
The passport
Thank
is
you.
The same issue. They have to produce their what they rely upon. We are not going to tell them what they rely upon. They have to tell us what they rely upon. See, then we can examine that. See, they'll say that you were doing an activity in the state of. You were doing an activity in the state of Texas. Well, okay, they made the statement. They made the claim. They got a sworn statement in the record. Okay, what evidence do you have that I did an activity in the state of Texas? They have to produce it. We don't want to muddy the water by saying this or that or that's not true. No, let's just see what they can produce. They have to support their claim. If they can't support their claim, we did an activity in the state of Texas means nothing. If they can't support their claim, and the court will dismiss the case.
Excellent, thank you, Ron. Coco here in Florida, and he has the last question. Then we're going to go home. Ron.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Fine.
Yes. Comment and opinion. There's been a lot of conversation about tickets and being pulled over, this and that. Why try to act as a street side courtroom? You're trying to try the case along the street, and all you have to do is no comment, Fifth Amendment, legal counsel, and leave it at that. Don't show them anything. Don't do it. Don't say anything. And they have to prove that they have authority. They're on the street corner to conduct a trial.
That is true. I had one of the sharpest lawyers I've ever met with. When he gets pulled over, he says, "Officer, what do you claim here? well, this and this and this and this. And he says, okay, let's go to trial. Let's go. Where do you want me to drive to? We're going to go to trial right now. He says, no, I'm going to give you a citation and then we will arrange the trial. He said, no. You claim that I did something. You claim you have the evidence already. You claim how you've got the freshest evidence right now. It happened just minutes ago. Let's go to trial. And he's successfully convinced them. They just back off and say, oh, well, we're not going to do that. We'll just dismiss this ticket right here and Greg Boyd on the ticket. But you're right. You have a right. If you're driving, let's say you live in Pennsylvania and you're driving through Texas and they give you a ticket. You don't have to drive back down from Pennsylvania 2 weeks later or 30 days later to go to trial. As a man, you have a right to go to trial right there and then. They have to convene their courts and have trial right there and then. It's in the Bill of Rights. I can't remember which Bill of Rights he relied upon to do that. I think it's a common law speedy trial, which means here, right now. See, the common law speedy trial is, in the old days, if you did something in a community and it was still light outside, they'd have trial right away, right there. But if it was dark, they'd wait till the next morning. But, They didn't wait a couple months for the trial. It was immediately. The people were right there. You had trial. You convened some people for a jury. Anyway, that hasn't changed. You have that right to that trial right there, right then. And, they cannot drag you. They cannot, force you to come back to trial unless you sign the ticket that you're willing to do it. So you just never sign those tickets. But you do have to identify yourself. You do have to give your full name. You can't be given a name that will a common law jury would say, you're trying to just hide from the responsibility. Don't do that. It's not worth it. Give them a date of birth because that helps to narrow it down. And then a mailing location. They're going to want your resident address. You don't have to give them a resident address. You don't have to do anything like that. And then if you don't want to give them a mailing contact, I had a friend of mine that was a paralegal. He said, here, he held his hand out. He says, right here. If you want to deliver a document to me, lay it right there in my hand. That's my mailing location. So pretty interesting. But he said that, that one sharp lawyer, he said, you just said that you have all the evidence and that you have everything to justify writing me a citation. So let's go to trial right now. Pretty interesting. Okay. Does that help your question? You have more of an answer than the question for us.
Don't have a comment.
Okay.
Yes. Most of the conversations I've been listening to are combative. You never want to go to war with the government. Go in as a friendly client and ask questions, but do not challenge them. Do not fight with them. That's what they want. They want you to fight and go to war because they will beat you. But if you go in on a friendly notice, they don't know how to respond to you.
It's true. That hotshot lawyer I was talking about, that's exactly what he said, the same thing. He says you never tell them this or that, or that doesn't apply, or they can't do this. Never say that. You always say, one of his favorite lines is, where in the Constitution am I forbidden to take this automobile and traverse that road right there, just like I was doing on such and such day? Where in the Constitution am I forbidden to do that? They have to produce that. He goes into federal court and he says, Your Honor, where in the Constitution am I forbidden from carrying a gun into this courtroom today? and he just lets the judge know that he's keeping the burden of proof on them completely. That's very interesting, the reaction he gets. And then he does that with the charges they bring against him. Because normally when he does that, he's got a client that he just goes in as a friend of the court. But he'll have a client that just got pulled over and had a gun in his car or whatever as a right. Basically the judge knows that, it's going to go to, where in the Constitution does this man forbid from having a gun in his car, having it laying on his seat loaded? Where in the Constitution is he forbidden from doing that? Now, if they can produce something from the Constitution, okay, let's go. Let's study that. But until they do that, if they can't produce evidence out of the Constitution to support their actions against you, they don't have jurisdiction. Because all their jurisdiction is derived from the Constitution. Supremacy laws requires it. Okay, let's close her up then, Michael.
I have one question. Do you know someone by the name of Paul Capel or ever heard of him?
No, I haven't.
Okay. He's a gentleman I used to listen to who has educated me in a lot of this, what you're trying to do.
Yeah. And I agree. Be very kind to these people along the road because they're not used to it. And they're just, most of them are just trying to do the best job they can with their job. And just be very kind to them. Some of them are jerks, but you don't have to fuel that. Just be very kind to them. Even the jerks will respond eventually. Sometimes those jerks are the most reasonable guys out there if you get a chance to explain to them the Bill of Rights. They'll be the first ones to admit that, hey, you're right. Okay, Michael, go ahead.
Thank you. All right. I want to thank everybody for joining us this evening. Next week, same time, same place. Bring your friends. Bring your questions. Until then, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.